I don't have a PowerPoint. First of all, because I don't know how to do one. And secondly, because I'm nervous enough, and if this thing didn't work, so I thought, right, I'm not going to chance it. So you're just going to have to look at me instead. So apologies. Okay. I want to thank David and James for this opportunity to share with you, because sometimes, you know, those of you who know us know that we've had a very interesting couple of years. And, you know, sometimes God does things with you and shows you things and teaches you things. And I think the way I put it to James was, I feel that God has put something in my hand and I don't quite know what to do with it. But I couldn't put it down. And there was thoughts there that I just couldn't put down, and felt that, you know, from maybe what we've learned and are still learning, that maybe, you know, there was things that God could speak to you and share with you as well. And during last year particularly, I spent a lot of time in Exodus and was looking at particularly the journey of the children of Israel through the desert. But at the beginning of this year, I started to look at the character of Moses. And there was sort of two pictures. We all know the picture of the little baby in the bulrushes, and that's probably one of the first stories that you ever learn in Sunday school. And then we know that he took the people through the wilderness and he came to Canaan. But at the beginning, there's only two or three chapters at the beginning of Exodus that really, really God spoke to me about. And it's more to do with Moses himself, with his character, with who he was. And that's what I began to look at. And sometimes, even though we know the story, and even though we've read the story, and I've probably sort of, you know the story of Moses from this high, we can still make assumptions about people. And, you know, we forget that, you know, Moses actually was, to all intents and purposes, the grandson of a pharaoh. And I think in Exodus 7, it tells us there that Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. This was a powerful man. This was not just some, you know, poor man in the sticks. This was a powerful man. He lived the life of the Egyptians. And we have to maybe make an assumption that maybe when his mother was looking after him earlier on, that she would have taught him the ways of the Hebrew people. So there was that in the back of his mind. But also, there was all this going on in the life of the palace. His mother, I presume, maybe would have told him a little bit about his history and about the people that were his people, but he wasn't able to live with. And then, of course, we know that he kills the Egyptian. And what is really interesting is if you read this story in the book of Acts, it talks about Moses, and it uses the words, and he supposed that his brethren would understand that he was the guy that was going to deliver them. Unfortunately, they didn't. And they didn't want anything to do with him. So here's this man, very powerful, very together guy, who was used to people bowing down before him, assuming, yes, okay, he'd killed an Egyptian, but it was okay because the Hebrew people were there and they're his people. But actually, they didn't want anything to do with him either. They didn't want to know. And they were saying to him, oh, okay, so you're going to kill us, are you? Like you did the Egyptian. So you've got to understand, you know, these people were very wary about this guy. This was a guy that had been brought up as an Egyptian. What did he know about them? What did he know about their suffering? What did he know about their way of life? And I often think when I read about Moses and when I've been thinking about him, I think, you know, this poor guy, if he'd been born sort of, you know, in our sort of era, he'd have probably been in therapy for years, or in, you know, having counselling for years, for all that happened to him, you know, this poor little soul taken from his mother, put in a basket, sent down a river, and here he is in this castle, and I think this poor man, you know, and now, from this, from the hierarchy, suddenly, he's looking after sheep in the desert that are not even his own sheep. This is a come down. This is a come down. From a guy who was used to people bowing before him, suddenly he's a nobody. And when you look in, I think it's Exodus about 3, chapter 3, he starts to look at, who am I? Who am I? And I could really relate to this guy at this point. Who am I? I remember feeling at one point as a mum you know, getting to the end of the day and thinking, where's Chris? Where's Chris? Because I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter-in-law, I'm a granddaughter, I'm a teacher. I sometimes feel like a social worker, I'm a counsellor, I'm a taxi driver, I'm a cook, I'm a cleaner. I'm there late at night when I wash the clothes or when the kids come in and want to talk. And you get to the end of the day and you think, where am I? Who am I? Where do I fit into all this? And the world has got it down to a fine art. You know, when you meet somebody new, they ask you, are you married? What's your name? Are you married? What's your job? Where do you live? And immediately an assumption is made about who you are. I saw a really interesting article a few weeks ago where a newspaper took three women, three young girls, early 20s, and asked them to dress up as though they were going out on a Saturday night. Well, if you've been in Cardiff or Newport on a Saturday night, you know what they look like, all right? Just about a dress, you know, the six-inch heels. And then they asked members of the public to have a look at them and to try and say where they were from. And there was things like, well, they probably work for Lidl's. They're probably on benefit. They're probably from the inner city. And I expect, you know, that one is probably divorced. So an assumption was made straight away. Without them saying anything, they didn't have to speak. And then they took these three same young women and they got in the professionals. They dressed them up. They did the makeup, the hair, everything about them. Asked the same members of public or members of the public, what can you tell me about these three women? Ah, well, they're obviously professionals. They're obviously, you know, solicitors or teachers, and they've probably got their own home and, you know, they live in suburbia. And suddenly, what they looked like made an impression of on the people who was actually looking at them. And immediately, something went into their heads about what these women were, and an assumption was made. I read somewhere in the last couple of weeks, which I thought was fantastic, and if you work in education, definitely the right thing to say. So it said, society makes you fit in so you can be ignored. And that is a terrible, terrible thing to say. Unfortunately, it's the truth. And for those of us maybe who went to Pentrebain a couple of years ago, we heard people saying this, actually saying this. We're ignored. Nobody cares about us. Cardiff, you know, City Council, whatever, don't want to know anything about us. And they felt, yes, they fitted in. Yes, they did the right things. But actually, they were ignored. Nobody cared about them. And so we get lost in this caricature of who we think we should be or what other people think we should be. Sadly, you know, the influence, and we can get damaged by the world, and that can seep into the church, where it suddenly becomes important, you know, are you a small group leader? Or do you teach in Sunday school? Or I once had a very interesting discussion with a lady who for 2 hours told me all about her giftings. Now, at the time, God was dealing with me on something. So when she asked me, you know, what do you do? I said, oh, nothing. I haven't got a gifting. And I had this very sorrowful, that's sad. You know, you're obviously not very, you know, you're not very into God then, because, you know, a bit sad. But what happens to us if we can't do that job? Who are we? What happens to us when suddenly we can't do the job that we think is so important? Word of testimony, so I apologise. It's always better to look at yourselves. A few years ago, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I've always been a mother. I love being a mother. I still love being a mother. That's who I am. And, you know, that's it. You know, society doesn't like it very much. Mothers don't rate very high. But I think it's the best job in the world. And a few years ago, I got to a stage where I suppose it was emptiness syndrome. And I can feel myself getting a bit, so apologies, I'm not very good. The people who know me, I do tend to get a bit emotional. And it was a time when David was going with Hannah, and so, you know, we knew that that relationship was going to blossom. John was looking for a house. Abby was looking to move out into college, maybe thinking about going away to college. And suddenly it was like, ooh, panic, empty nest. Hang on a minute, this is not right, this is not right. And very, very clearly after the new year, I felt God saying, Chris, you need to come away from the children's work. So I did what I usually do first, and that is ignore it. It might go away. Okay? Just pretend you haven't heard, and then maybe God will choose something else or say something else. But it wouldn't go away. Now I'm getting angry. Because God knows that I'm a mother at heart. God knows that I love children. God knows that that's been my life. God knows this. God knows this. What's he doing? He's got it wrong. And we went to Weston that year. For those of you who maybe haven't been with us very long, we used to go to Weston in the March. And I got all the children's things ready. And off we went to Weston. And everybody was saying to me, "This, you know, Chris, this has got to be the best Weston we've ever been to." And I'm thinking, no, it's not. I want to go home. I just want to go home. I don't want to be here. I don't want to hear what God is saying. I want to go home. And over the weeks, God began to deal with me about who I was. Where was my rock? Where was my foundation? Where was my identity? My identity was in mother, Sunday school teacher, but not in God. So when things rocked, when my foundation started to rock, so I started to rock. Because my foundation was in how people saw me, how people recognized me. They recognized me because I was a mother, because I was a Sunday school teacher. So my identity began to go up the wall, really. And God had to deal with that. God had to very, very gently start to work with me, start to show me who I was in God. If you read in Exodus 3, you read how God approaches Moses. Here's a guy who's lost it all, must have been in absolute turmoil, thinking maybe himself, God had called him to do something, and yet, what was he doing here in the desert? Nothing, he had nothing. But God immediately gives him an identity. He doesn't get angry with him. He doesn't say, for goodness sake, Moses, pull yourself together. Sort yourself out. You know, I've said this, I've done, you know. But immediately gives him an identity. And he says to him, I am your, the God of your father. He could have said, I'm the God of Abraham and Jacob. But he didn't. He made it very, very personal. I am the God of your fathers, immediately Moses has a place in history. He has a place in God's plan. He has a place in life. Immediately, that's his place. That's his point of contact with God. Somebody, I think it was Spurgeon, said, "If you want to know who you are in God, get to know who God is." And that's the bottom line. Get to know who God is if you want to know who you are. What does God say to us? He says the same thing. He doesn't get angry when we lose it, when we miss out. He doesn't get angry. He tells us we're his workmanship. He says, David, you are seated in heavenly places. He says, Margaret, you are chosen before the foundation of the world. He says, you are children of God. He says, you are the joint heirs of Christ. He says, you are the sons of God. He says, you now have the right to call me Daddy, Abba, Father. You're the apple of my eye. Your name is written on the palm of my hand. You're a chosen race. You're a royal priesthood. You're a people for God's possession. Suddenly, we have an identity. As Chris Williams, I don't have a family identity for various reasons. I don't have one. But in Christ, I have an identity. Spurgeon says, when a text gets hold of you, the chances are you've got hold of the text. These verses are there. Now, we can read this as a lovely history book. We can read it as a poetry book. But do these verses get hold of us? Do they grip our hearts? Do they cause us to stand and believe that when he says, you are joint heirs with Christ, he means it? When he says, you are my workmanship, you are my beloved. You know, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called the children of God. It's God breathing the truth into us of who we are. So we can stand tall. We can stand straight. We can stand believing in all that God has given us. You know, even after Moses, I love Moses, because even after his encounter with God and he comes to the burning bush, he's still saying, yes, but, you know, who am I? And, ooh, I'm not sure I can do that. And, you know, he's still very unsure, very unsure. But God just says to him, when you go to the people, because that's his worry, and I think I'd be worried, when you go back, he says to him, but you say to them, I am, has sent you. He's not going back just as Moses now, but he's going back carrying the power and the presence of God. I am is with him. And we can have all that we've got, and we've, you know, just heard about Tearfund. How blessed are we living in this culture? We can have new buildings, we can do street pastoring, we can do networking, but unless we're carrying the presence of God, then it's not worth anything. It's worth nothing. We need to be convinced of this. You know, the world has seen so many initiatives. In education, we've got initiatives coming out of our ears. Initiative for this, initiative for that, initiative for the other. What the world needs to see, what the people out there need to see, is the presence of God. And we carry it. How amazing is that? How incredible is that? Projects won't do it. We can't do it with projects. But we can carry the presence of God. I was thinking when I was ill, you know, last year, one of the things that God really spoke to me about was this thing about identity. But not having that sort of earthly identity, if you like, from the past, and not knowing ancestry and everything like that. But God took me to that verse in Hebrews, and I was reminded again of it this morning in Hebrews 12, where it talks to us about being surrounded by a great host of witnesses. And, you know, those days when we feel we can't get out of bed, and there were days like that last year when I felt couldn't get out of bed, where I felt, oh, I just feel so weak. I don't know what today is going to bring. And to just realize that we are surrounded by this great crowd of witnesses just cheering us on. I was in the Millennium Centre yesterday watching the rugby. So apologies to Josh and Maynard. It's the first time I've ever been. I'll never go again, so they won't lose, just in case. But just hearing, you know, when Wales scored whatever they score in rugby, the cheer that went up, you know, the excitement of it. And I, just as I was reading this verse again this morning, I just felt, and I feel prophetically God saying, what he said to me last year, it was like, come on, Chris, you can do it. Those mornings when I just felt, oh, I'm walking treacle here. What's happening here? What's God doing? Those mornings when I felt, I can't get out of bed. I just don't want to face the world today. And it's like you've got this crowd just cheering you on. You know, it's like, come on, Chris, you're going to do it. You're going to make it. Keep going. And I just felt this morning as well, God saying to that, you know, new life. You don't know what the future holds, but come on. You're going to do it. You're going to make it. You're going to get there. This is not a triumphalistic, you know, preach. Don't believe in that, because life is life. All right? This is the cheering when we don't feel like it. This is the cheering when things get tough, when things get hard, when it's not always what we think it should be. But this is when that crowd bursts. And I'm sure they heard us all over Cardiff yesterday, but heaven resounds with, come on, you're going to make it. You're going to get there. As you're standing in the presence of God, you are going to get there. There's a guy in the 1930s, a guy called Frank Laubach. And he got to, it was about 1913, he was about 40 at the time, and a Christian, and feeling, you know, what had he achieved? He was a guy, businessman, very, very good businessman, made a lot of money, but feeling, what have I achieved? And he decided that he needed to get back into the presence of God. He needed to stand before God, in the sort of temple of God. And so he set himself this challenge of every day, at some point in the day, he would connect with God. Sometimes it was just something like, thank you for the sun. Sometimes just thank you for the beautiful things. Other times it was, Father God, I'm in a mess, help me. But at certain points in the day, he decided he would connect with God. After that, one of the things that happened was he actually introduced the Each One, Teach One literacy program, where he taught over 60 million people to read in their own language. But that was not his accomplishment. He didn't see that as an accomplishment. And in 1930, he wrote a little book called Practicing His Presence. And in that, he said, the sense of cooperation with God in little things is what astonishes me. My part is to live this hour in continuous inner conversation with God and in perfect responsiveness to his will, to make this hour gloriously rich. And I thought, I can manage an hour. I can't manage maybe a day or a week, but I can manage an hour. I can look for the next hour to God. I can look for those next few minutes, those 60 minutes. I can manage that, of looking back to God and living in his presence. I've got a little chap at school who's autistic and a lovely, lovely little boy, but no sense of direction or anything. And he tends to disappear regularly. But he's got to the point now where we've got this little thing going where he sets off and then suddenly stops and he looks for me. It's like, oh, that's okay, Mrs. Williams is there, I can go on. And then he'll go again. He'll stop again, look again. Oh, that's okay, Mrs. Williams is there, I'm fine, I can go again. And I thought, you know, how we need to learn that with God. You know, if you're like me, I like to go out through the door, off down the lane, gone. But how we need to learn to maybe stop and look for the presence of God. Lord, where are you right now? Where are you in this situation? And one lovely thing this Frank Laubach said was, it's difficult to convey to another the joy of having broken into the new sea of realizing God's here-ness. And I love that word, here-ness. We talk about God's nearness a lot, and it's absolutely true. But there's something about that word, here-ness. So when I'm at school having a really bad day or a bad week, or in fact a bad term, I know that God's not waiting at home for me. He's not waiting outside the classroom. He's actually here. He's here. He's here. He's in me. He's surrounding me. He's covering me. He's blessing me. He's walking with me. And how much now we need to learn to stand in his presence. You know, the worship this morning was just so lovely. I just so enjoyed it. But it's not about what we do. It's about who we are. It's not about all the things that we do. And we all do wonderful things, amazing things. But it's not about what we do. It's about who we are. Who are we in God? If you're not sure, go to these verses. Go to these verses and just ask God to write them upon your heart, upon your mind, upon your spirit, upon your being. This is who you are. The world might tell you different, but this is the truth. This is what God says about you. This is the truth. And then standing in his presence day by day, moment by moment, those times when, really, You just wonder what the day is going to hold. Every minute of every day, God is walking with you. Watchman Nee, I'm going to finish with this. Watchman Nee wrote a lot of books. But he wrote one, The Normal Christian Life. Wonderful little book. And that, he was talking about the loaves and the fishes. And you know, our hearts, and I think James prayed this morning, our hearts is to reach out to the people out there, is to reach out to those that are lost, to reach out to those that need us. And Watchman Nee says this, standing in the presence of God, knowing God's presence, will be when the fruit of your service, so the fruit of your doing, is out of all proportion to the gifts that you possess. Many of us expect results commensurate with what we are in ourselves and in our own diligence. But the blessing of God is fruit that is out of correspondence with what we do. But if we set our hearts upon seeking God, we shall find that things happen that are altogether out of keeping with our capacity and surpass even our dreams. How releasing that is. We don't have to make it happen. We don't have to make sure that certain things happen. God is going to do it for us as he lives in us and works through us and uses us, and we carry his presence with us into every day.